the hospital, or two, mm-hmm. selling UDC's radio station. It was a voice. It was a voice of the people here in the city. Yeah. And the people don't have that voice anymore.
Right.
Which station was that?
WDCU. It was owned by UDC.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Terrell is from D.C. He was born and raised there as well, so he's very familiar with the city. Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Terrell, what's your last name?
James.
Terrell James. Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're on. We're rolling.
We're rolling.
We're rolling, yeah.
All right. Well, this is a pleasure.
It is.
Today we have Sam Ford with us.
Yep.
And Christopher Oglesby as well. Now I'm Terrell James. Yep. Today we want to talk a little bit to Sam about his history in D.C. as a newscaster. Some of the amazing things that you've done, that you've accomplished. And also want to get into some other things, but also want to talk about the connection between the two of you and how the two of you met. But before we do, before we get to you, I want to get to the accolades, okay?
Yeah. First, you got a long way to go.
Exactly. Well, one of the founding members of the National Association of Black Journalists. Mm-hmm. He's covered the news for over 50 years, 40 years in D.C., right?
About 36. Probably longer than that.
I came here in 82, so 42 years in D.C.
Okay, yeah, 42. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you were also inducted into the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. Mm-hmm. Did I leave anything out as far as your accolades? It's probably a long list of things.
Let me go.
Okay.
He also has several Emmys.
Many things, that's an important one. Yeah. That's huge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much what he got. Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. It's way more stuff than that, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But we'll be all day trying to run everything down. Right. All the many, many accomplishments that this legend this legend has, you know what I mean? So
what we can get started by talking about the connection between the two of you, because essentially that's how we ended up here.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it that you saw in Chris that made you want to follow his story when he was, 10 years old?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Well, what happened? It was Channel 7, I think it was 1989, yep, something like that.
Yep,
we had a news director. He's no longer with us, the late Bob Richbloom. He told me to go out into the streets of D.C. and mm-hmm. find two kids. One kid who was basically just sort of out there, and that was Christopher. And then another kid who was basically had some
more structure.
Yeah, into mm-hmm. his life and like that. So I went out to New York and Bladensburg Road. There were still are two Exxon gas stations
right there. Yeah.
And
everything's still
there. There was Christopher asking people to pump their gas for him. Mm-hmm. And so I watched this young man and I asked him if we could talk to him, and he was very nice. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And before long, I had not only met him, I'd met his mother, I'd met the people that he sold papers for in mm-hmm. the afternoon. Mm-hmm. Just a lot of folks. And so we did the story with Christopher in his situation. And then we did a story with another kid mm-hmm. who in the projects. And his mother was there to structural and guide him and that sort of thing. In Christopher's case, they lived in a homeless shelter. It was called mm-hmm. the Capital City Inn.
Yes, Capital City Inn.
And apparently everything went in this place.
Yeah,
I mean, it was, eventually they just destroyed it, and tore it down.
I think it's a Salvation Army there now.
But you sit there and you look, and here are these kids there. Amtrak trains are whizzing by 50 miles an hour past the place. I'm amazed no kid ever got killed there. But I mean, it's there's a train leaving every hour
for New York. What's crazy is we used to jump on the train.
On the trains,
the slower trains, not the Amtrak's, the slower, because they had freight trains that used to come by as well.
Okay.
And I would jump on, I had an uncle that lived in the Fort Lincoln area, and I would jump on the freight train because I knew that train would go that route. That was one of our transportations to get back and forth. Sometimes we would jump on a freight train. Yeah.
Well, as I said, it was amazing, but this was a combination of basically poor people, mm-hmm. lots of little kids. As he explained to me, lots of drug dealers, moms, and it was a sad situation.
But
he didn't go to school, he did go to sell newspapers every evening, and there would be a guy to come through. And you got guys like that and people like that almost everywhere where they take some interest in the local kids mm-hmm. and they try to do something to help them. And mm-hmm. so in this case, the guy would go and they would take these kids on a van, take them to Union Station, mm-hmm. and hand them papers, and they would sell the Washington Times, the morning papers that hadn't sold that morning, mm-hmm. and people would buy the papers mm-hmm. from the kids. And we had about Christopher that's amazing to me is, you know, he's always, again, as a child, he was just a lovely child, you know, mm-hmm. just a very nice kid. And I think, you know, he went through a lot, but mm-hmm. I think that is what has brought you where you are today. Because you were a nice person. I mean, you know, that has to be.
I was just good at pulling the wool over people's eyes. I wasn't really that nice. No, I'm joking.
I had my issues as well.
I was very respectful as a kid. Like I didn't disrespect adults that, you know, didn't disrespect me. Like I wasn't one of those type of kids, you know. Yeah. So, you know. But I had a lot of stuff going on, things that I would get into as kids get into in the neighborhood. Yeah. So, you know. But you know, I always had my, you know, I always had that mentality of the, you know, just trying to do better and trying not to fall into a certain
That was the thing that impressed me. And as it turned out, there was a lady that
I went to church with named
Bernice Muskelly. Mm-hmm. And she knew you. She was one of your counselors or something like that. Okay. She worked with the family. So she knew the family quite well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I told her about the story that I was doing. But,
So what was it about Sam that made you trust him enough to let him follow you?
Well, I kind of recognized him from TV, but I didn't recognize him. I remember seeing him. But it was just like, you know, when he asked me, I was like, okay, you know, of course you got to ask my mother first, you know, make sure everything's good and everything like that. And I just, the excitement of being on TV was one of the things, of course, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've never had that experience before of nobody coming to ask me or wanting to actually follow my life or ask about my life or what's going on and things like that. So it was just the excitement behind that. It was a little nervous. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? A little nerve set in, but, you know, other than that, it was just cool, you know?
Well, the thing that got me
is that when I talked to his mother, she said he wanted to be
a hustler when he grew up.
Well, actually, I said that when you asked me, but I think it got kind of convoluted as far as, like, what I meant when I said that.
Why do you want to be a hustler when you grow up?
So I can make a lot of money.
They also go to jail, don't they?
Not if they got a job.
Well, I got the impression, well, what I said in the piece, I don't think he really knew what a hustler was.
Well, in that time, we didn't think of hustlers as, main, you know, the stigma on hustlers was like they was drug dealers or just anything to do for money. More of a hustler with us was that we did what we had to do to get money, you know what I mean? So that was a hustler for me, whether it was legal, illegal, anything like that. I didn't necessarily mean that I wanted to be a drug dealer or anything like that.
So you were pumping gas, you were hustling.
Hustling. Yeah, you know, whatever. Because mm-hmm. at that time, I was pumping gas. I was selling candy door to door as well. Mm-hmm. And I was selling the newspaper. So, you know, whatever we had to do to survive almost, you know, because we had to make some money to eat most of the time.
Yeah. They were hitters. Mm-hmm. But they were just very nice. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. We did the two kids story. So we did a story on Christopher. Uh-huh. And then we also did a story on a guy named James Green, mm-hmm. Who was a student at Turner Elementary School with his mother. So we looked at their different lives mm-hmm. and we did the piece. And, you know, over the years, I just stayed with it. I mean, Christopher and his family, they were very cooperative. Me and Hal Herman, was mm-hmm. this cameraman, uh-huh. came, and Hal was just really nice, too. I mean, everybody got along really well. Mm-hmm. He was 13 at that time. He was 10 the first time I talked to him. 10. He was 13 mm-hmm. by that time. He was at a junior high school, doing very well, being a very happy young man, you know, mm-hmm. having a good time. And so it was, as I said, it was a happy time, right? Mm-hmm. When I came back the next time,
he was 17 and he was having trouble. He
had apparently been hanging out with the wrong crowd. Mm-hmm. And he had his own pit bull, as I recall, mm-hmm. and you know, all this mess, this stuff. And so when I came back at 21, he was in prison. He was not there. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't see him for years. Mm-hmm. And then I think when I was about, he was about 30, I decided, well, let's just go back over there and see if we can find him. Mm-hmm. And so me and my camera woman, the woman Peggy Gilgannon, we worked together every day. And we went over there and we found him. father raising five boys by himself.
At the time, it was only five.
But it blew our minds. Mm-hmm, but, you know, because this was not, you know, he was headed the wrong way. And the grin on my face was so tight, it was starting to hurt my jaw. I was so happy. So, you know, and then, of course, we did a final story on you. I said, I wanted, before I retired, I wanted to do another story on you. And I did a story on him and his boys. Those little boys were young men at this point. And
not little anymore.
No,
not little by no means. Yeah, yeah.
And they were, you know, saying, "Hey, Pop, where you want me to put this?" Yeah. I was like, "I love this." Yeah. I loved it. I loved it. Just you know, the over the years,
everything came full circle, man. It was just you know, it was just it's a blessing, man. You know, like you said, it was a lot to go through. There's a lot of struggles. You know, even with me raising the boys and everything like that, it was a lot of struggles. But you know, I kept at it. You know, I kept at it. So,
yeah, well, you have my absolute
admiration.
I can tell you that. I appreciate it.
And I guess it was 2019. I don't know, one of these
2017, recent, I think it was.
One of these years, I decided that we wanted to do a Father of the Year for Father's Day. And I said, Christopher, can you come over to the church, you and your boys? And we showed the video. And we named him Father of the Year.
Yeah.
And that was, as I said, that was just wonderful.
That was bittersweet for me, man.
I admire you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
One of the happier stories of my career.
Yeah.
Now, in the case of the other young man, his name was James. He was about 10 years old, too, at the time. And the thing was, he was trying to do a good job. He was trying to be you know, a productive student in school. And when the kids saw that,
you know, for example, Christopher, he's his own
man. And I don't think he cares what other people think.
No,
you know?
Never
but
have.
But James was not like that. And so they were teasing him. And he decided he didn't want to be on TV anymore. He wouldn't even talk to me. You know, he wouldn't even talk to me because he was tired of being teased.
Mm.
So I just had a shot of him when he was like 14, and that's all I could get was just a shot of him. And then at some point, I don't know if he was 19, it was some point later, he got into some trouble. And so his mother asked if I would write a letter on his behalf.
Oh, that's fun.
And so to the judge. And I wrote the letter. And I never really heard any more after the letter. Then it seems I saw him one day, and I don't know, some years later, I'm at the D.C. court, and this man walks up to me and starts smiling. And he looked familiar to me, but I just, you know, and I said, "Yeah, you look familiar, but I'm sorry, I don't know who you are." And he said, "I'm James Green." And I was like, "James, the little boy." And at that point, we exchanged information. And at this point, him and Christopher are the same age. He's on man almost 40. At this point, he's not intimidated by you know, that sort of stuff. And as it turned out, he owned
a barbershop.
He owns a barbershop in Waldorf.
Yeah.
So we did the piece, I guess, a couple of years ago, like at Christmas, just to say, you know, a Christmas time story. And we looked at both their lives.
Now they say you're going to either end up dead or in prison, right?
Yes. Well, but we ended up in prison. But after that, they learned things in prison that both of them told me they learned things in prison that helped them when they got out of prison. And so both of them are independent businessmen now, you know? And I just, again, I ended the story by saying, folks, it ain't all bad news. It ain't all bad news because we picked these two young men totally at random. And we just followed their lives for, 30 years?
30 years,
And it ain't all bad news.
Well, I'm 45 now, so when did we do the last piece? About 3 years? About 3 or 4
something
years
like
ago?
That.
About 4 years ago, I want to say.
Something like that. Yep. But that's it. But it's, you know, again, it's not all bad news. And you know, as I said, I love hearing his oldest son say, "Hey, Pop, where you want us to put this?"
Equipment.
Yeah, man, that's a beautiful thing, man.
You said it ain't all bad news. I'm glad that you said that. I want to shift gears for a second. Okay, I got a question for you. So the quote I don't know if we're going to credit Mark Twain with this or Denzel Washington or both of them. Mm-hmm. But the quotes, if you read the news, you're misinformed. If you don't read the news, then you're uninformed. Mm. You ever heard that before?
No, but it could be the case.
Okay. And actually, that was going to be my question. How do you feel about that? Do you feel that that's the case?
No. No, I don't, you know, like some people don't understand the news, and so therefore they are intimidated by reporters. Obviously, I'm one of those people, right? So I'm not intimidated by my people.
Exactly, right.
Because we're just people like everybody else. We make mistakes. I think most of us are out there to hurt anybody. Right. You know, I think we have good intentions, but sometimes pressures to be first or pressures to claim you know something you don't or pressures what causes people to do things that they really shouldn't be doing.
Yeah. Right.
So you realize, so you gotta have, basically what you do is, you gotta have some, let's say, question the information.
Okay.
And the way that you deal with that is you don't get one news source. Mm-hmm. You know, if I wanna know what happened, and you were there, I want to hear from you, and then I want to hear from you too.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I want to hear from him and her. You see what I'm saying? So let's say there's some story that happened. I think you got, what, 4 or 5 channels in D.C.? Look at all of them. Mm-hmm. Listen to the radio. Read the Post. You know, so it's, if you do all that, you're not going to be misinformed.
Okay.
Because you're hearing different things from different sources.
Well, I don't think you're going to. Well, if you're hearing different things from different sources, you got to sort of figure out who's right and who's not.
Yeah, okay. That's what I was going to ask you. Like, how do you gauge on your report, like what to report on as far as the facts or anything like that? Like, how do you know what you can put out there that's factual to where it doesn't come back on you as being, you know, false reporting?
Well, you, well, if
because I know you always run the risk.
I'm reporting it. I know what's right and what's not. You know what I'm saying? If I'm reporting it, or in some cases, we just don't know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's part of a story too.
Okay.
We just don't know.
Okay.
But I don't have any. You know, if you know, generally you figure out, and after 50 years as a reporter, I've learned you can generally figure out who's lying. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Going on, I don't think I've ever been fooled. I mean, you know, I don't.
You know, maybe it's happened, but I don't think so.
Yeah.
Because you can just generally, you know, you get a feel for people just like you all.
Yeah.
You meet somebody, you can tell somebody's lying.
You can talk
to
a lot of people out there and a lot of different personalities and things of that nature.
Right.
So,
sometimes it may be hard to figure out,
right.
You know, right away, which is what I said. You may not know what the real story is. Mm-hmm. And that may be what you report, right? Mm-hmm. But you don't get fooled too much.
How'd you end up being the guy that was always in the thick, like didn't want to, like wasn't scared to be in a certain neighborhood?
I'm a black man.
Yeah.
all
the black on black crime out there, I mean, you got to.
Yeah, well.
Especially, you know, with people not wanting to be in front of cameras and stuff like that.
If they don't want to be in front of camera, you leave them alone.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not going to, you going to talk to me.
No. Yeah, yeah.
You ever been chased out of a neighborhood or anything like that?
Well, yeah. I remember in Miami, all right, during the riots.
Okay,
Me and a guy named Reggie Huff. That's when I was with CBS News.
Mm-hmm.
We were in there, and so we were with the reporters. We decided that we were going to go into Liberty City, which is this part of Miami.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we said we're going into Liberty City. We're going to look around, and you know. So we got a caravan of reporters together. We got a bunch of cars.
Mm-hmm.
We drove on in there. We're going to show these people. We got in there and we saw they had already derailed a train. Like a train is on its side.
Uh-huh.
And then we hear shots.
Oh,
and
wow.
I said, Reggie, we blew out 3 tires getting out of that neighborhood.
Jeez.
And that's it. You know,
you continue risking your life for a story after that? Or was that the last time?
Again, you say risk your life. Sometimes you get intimidated and you go in there and the people are fine.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
you never know.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're thinking, oh, these people are, and you get in there and they like you. You know what I'm saying? Or even here in Maryland, I remember I was thinking, you know, I was in some white neighborhood with a bunch of, where they have a bunch of boats and stuff like that. And I'm like,
Where I live at now.
God, I'm walking through this neighborhood, and I thought, this is trouble. You know, I'm thinking, I'm not comfortable here, and I'm walking around, and then suddenly I hear Sam come out of my house, and these of course, white people. They're mm-hmm. like, I'd interviewed these people before. In another tragedy, in another part of Rusted Me. It's, mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So mm-hmm. it's just, you just never know. You gotta mm-hmm. you gotta go in there.
Uh-huh. Right.
Okay. And, mm-hmm. and if the attitude is such that you should get out of there, get out of there. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times, most of the time, they'll talk to you.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you just don't know. You gotta have the nerve to go in there.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. If you ain't got that kind of nerve, you don't need to be a reporter.
Right. So 1986, you are fired from CBS. That same day, you are offered a job by Channel 7. Tell me about those hours in between that. From the moment you were fired to the moment you were offered that job, what was going through your mind at that time?
Well, it was, I knew I was going to be fired. I mean, I sort of knew that. I mean,
because I had an agent. And the agent, he's plugged into CBS. Uh-huh.
Because I had to aid me, he said, I think you're a goner.
Okay.
And now the thing that was kind of surprising to me was, now this was, I was fired in August, I think, or mm-hmm. late July. Mm-hmm. I had just signed a new 4-year contract in April.
Oh wow!
Okay, so I mean, if the plan was to fire me,
why didn't you sign a contract?
The thing is, they just didn't have to renew me, and that mm-hmm. would have just been it. Mm-hmm. But they signed me up for 4 more years.
How long have you been there before then?
Probably 8 years.
Oh wow!
Maybe 9 years. Yeah, but anyway, I'd been there a while, mm-hmm. And so the idea was that they just wouldn't have done it. So anyway, I get this call, and he says, I think you're a goner now. This firing at CBS had been going on for a while, because I remember for this anchor man that worked at the station at uh-huh. WCCO in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. and I took the wife and kids up to northern Minnesota, where I'd once did a story, and I liked this place, where the Mississippi River starts, uh-huh. Lake Itasca, which is you can step across the Mississippi River.
Because
it starts coming out of this lake.
Mm-hmm.
So I go into the town to get breakfast that morning, and I'm looking at the Minneapolis paper and the front page about the firings at CBS News. And I'm looking there. And
you was looking for your name?
Yeah. I was looking. My job, what I did at CBS had been eliminated. I saw that it had been eliminated.
Oh, wow.
My job had been eliminated. Mm-hmm. And so then I'm looking for my name, and I don't see my name. So I call Washington, and I say, I just have two questions. Do I still work there?
And if so, what do I do when I come back? And they say, yeah, you still work here. You just
And him of reporters, because okay. I was anchoring the overnight news.
Oh, okay.
So, okay, that was fine. And so I went back. And then the next time, right, the next time, they got me.
Oh, wow.
You know?
And what was the reason why they did they just...
Oh, they...
I know they don't have to give a reason, but
No. I mean, it wasn't like they just fired me. They fired a bunch of people.
Oh, so there was more downsizing and things.
Right.
Okay,
it was these cut
budget
backs.
Cuts.
Yeah, yeah. They I forget how many people they fired that day, mm-hmm. but a bunch. I wasn't the only reporter there.
Oh, okay,
probably at least 5 reporters in the Washington bureau.
Oh, you know? Wow.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but anyway, I was one of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was it. So what was interesting was one of the producers at CBS. In Texas, mm. right? One of their offices in Texas mm-hmm. was the brother of the news director, but his brother was a producer at CBS uh-huh. worked in Texas. So he called Tom up and said, hey, you know, basically, people out there, new blood on the street, if you're interested in it, you know what I'm saying? So Channel 7 called me up, offered me a job.
That's cool, man. That's cool.
Yeah.
There was no nervousness in between that time that you were fired and the time that you received that other call?
That was nervous. I mean, I was, you know.
That's what I wanted to hear. I want to know what was going through your mind.
But the interesting thing about it is, which is weird, because, you know, if you've worked in a corporate America for a while,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are things that are put in place. I learned that life for the people with money uh-huh. is not like life for us.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have a baby, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got to figure out how to pay for that baby.
Yeah.
I have a baby. I'm working for CBS News. Mm-hmm. You know, I had 2 kids. You know how much they cost me?
$5. Both of them.
Oh, wow.
$5. Other way, insurance took care of it. Uh-huh. Everything took care of it. I didn't even have to pay. You know what I'm saying? So when they fired me, they gave me a bunch of money.
Oh, yeah?
I had...
Like a severance?
Yeah.
Okay.
I never got so much money. I'm serious. It was like, okay, you're fired, and here's your pension. But there was like a pension amount.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Here's the money you could do. I suggest you invest it. And then here's your severance. So, and then, you know, and so, boom.
I'm you doing good. Yeah, that's good, man. That's
well,
good.
Maybe even too good because I didn't have nothing to do, you know, for a while. And I didn't take that job with CBS or Channel 7 right away.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I wanted to study French, so I went to Canada and studied French.
Okay. I mean, when they give you a lump sum of money, that kind of makes you not think about going back
right.
to work.
Right. I fired in August.
We've seen that with the stimulus packages that
happened. I didn't go back to work until February.
Oh, wow.
You enjoyed that time off.
Well, I don't know if I enjoyed it. I think I blew it, really, honest with you. Oh, yeah. You know, it was not good.
I know the kids didn't mind having you home for a little bit more.
Well, you know, my son was probably 4. My daughter was a baby. Mm-hmm. She was a baby. But it was tense. And if I didn't have the wife I had,
uh-huh.
I don't think I would have been married 40 years.
Oh,
you know what I'm
man.
Saying? But she was mm-hmm. just a good woman, mm-hmm. and she put up with a lot of BS.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and then, you know, I realized I had to straighten up. I didn't want to lose my children.
Well, they're partying, was you?
I was
you out there? Oh,
I was
yeah,
out
really?
The street.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. So that was it. And so I realized I wanted my kids,
mm-hmm.
and that was more important to me than drinking, hanging on the streets.
Okay,
and I don't know, you know, I
what was the exact thing that caused you to make that transition back to I got to get my family right or anything like that? Was there a threat of separation or realizing it on your own?
Yeah, I realized. I mean, we weren't even getting along that good. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? And at one point, she didn't exactly put me out of the house, but it was just more pleasant. You know, I mm-hmm. went and lived with a guy named Joe. Mm-hmm. He was a reporter from Norfolk who moved to D.C. looking for mm-hmm.
And so I hung out with Joe.
and so as it turned out, you know, and then I just thought, hey, I gotta get
yourself together.
I gotta do that. Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, you lost your wife. Lost your wife.
2 years ago.
Two years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay.
Three. Was it
two and a half mm-hmm. years ago? It was mm-hmm. August of 21.
Okay. So, did covering certain stories do something to you after you lost your wife because you were making the connection to her?
Well, I mean, again, that was early in the marriage, right? Mm-hmm. You know,
well, kids, after she passed.
Kids were young.
After she passed,
well, after
and they're still trying to.
I was a seasoned reporter. In fact, I was thinking mm. about retiring then.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I remember talking to you.
And
you
my
were
wife
me about
said
that,
to me,
yeah.
she said, don't you retire, you go yeah. crazy. And so I thought, well.
You know, and then she got sick and then she died.
And I said, you know, if I hadn't had something to do, I would have gone crazy, mm-hmm. you know. And so that was good advice that she gave me. And she was a sweet lady. You know, we were both reporters. We met on a story.
Okay.
And so, you know, and, you know. And
you said y'all met on a story?
Yeah.
Ooh, let's talk about that. I want to hear about that.
Well, there was a guy named Jerry Small, okay? He was a Jewish guy. He
you remember a lot of names, too, Sam. Like,
well,
he's
a reporter.
Yeah.
We were more than casual friends. I mean, we used to get high together.
Oh, wow.
In fact, he was my marijuana dealer.
Oh, yeah. Y'all heard it here first. Y'all heard it here first. I've never heard Sam talk about any of these being in the streets or anything, so y'all heard it here first.
Well, this is
an exclusive.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so.
As it turned out, he worked with me. He was a CBS cameraman at first.
Mm-hmm. CBS. And then he quit CBS and he went to work for CNN.
Okay.
So anyway, he just called himself a Yentl, right? Which is, if you've seen Fiddler on the Roof.
That was
the person that hooks people up. So he decided that he was going to hook me up with some woman. And this woman that he hooked me up with was, I'm 26 years old, I don't know. But I decided to go on out with her because he, you know. But she had 4 children. And she smoked. Okay. So I mean, you're a young man. This is not exactly what I'd call.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. A hookup. Yeah, a hookup.
I was interested in. I'm like, what? So I get on this airplane. We're heading down to Tampa, Florida. Mm-hmm. Somebody had tried to kill President Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm. And we're and then Jerry's on the plane, and he starts rubbing his hands together. Have I got a woman for you? And I said, no, absolutely not. He said, and she's from Kansas. And I said, he's from Kansas, you know, because I'm from Kansas.
Hometown,
you
know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I was like, oh, well, maybe I will, you know.
Uh-huh.
So that's when I met my wife.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I said, when, you know, from that moment until 4:35 on August the 12th,
mm-hmm.
we were together.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. 41 years.
That's beautiful, man.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Well, when, and as it turned out, you know, Kansas is a small place. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of black people, really. But
right.
We got to talking, and we figured out. My sister, two of my sisters, and her brother sang in a band together.
Oh, yeah? Oh, wow. So it was destined for y'all.
So it was like, okay. And then she was telling about her brother was this guy named Ray, and Ray Murray, and he used to go with a girl named Maylene. And I was like, Maylene? And I just called her. I said, May, I said, you used to go with a boy from Wichita? She said, yeah. I said, what's his name? Ray Murray. So the families were connected, though right. We didn't know each other. Yeah. But, you know, right. That was it. So,
That's cool, though. So, all right. When you are, actually, you told a story on an interview that you did with your photographer. What's her name
was
again?
That with Peggy? Was Peggy? That the one we did
yes,
with Peggy?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Okay. So you told a story about you being in a car with a camera guy. And somebody had just gotten shot, and they came up to the car. And you turned to him and you said, grab the camera. Now, so my question is, tell to me about the line that you walk between being human and covering a story. Because it's like in that moment, you have a decision to make. It could be, let me help this guy, or grab the camera.
I can do both.
Yeah,
you can do both. It's not either or.
And okay.
That's what you we, you both, know,
yeah. Okay.
If there's no more help I could give him, I mean, I don't know anything about gunshot wounds.
Right, right.
You know? Okay. But the weird thing is, what happened when we were at Blue High School mm-hmm. and we were heading back to the station
mm-hmm.
and we're in a line of traffic there on Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
The guy got shot in the vehicle in front of us. It could have been us. I mean, that's what I'm thinking.
So it was a stray shooting? Is this
I got the impression that it wasn't intended for that man, per se. I mm-hmm. think it was just a shot.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But anyway, this guy gets out of the truck, and he's just kind of wandering around,
mm-hmm.
and, he walks up to me, and he says, I've just been shot. And I was like, what? He said, I've just been shot. I said, Brian, get the camera. And so we
that sounds like the internet today, like, you know, that's everything that goes on with social media.
So we stood out there with him. We talked to him. We, you know, made sure that somebody had called an ambulance. Mm-hmm. But the guy is wandering there. He's holding his chest, mm-hmm. walking around, and you know, you can see the agony mm-hmm. on his mm-hmm. face. And of course, Brian shooting it. You can see the little kids there. It was in mm-hmm. school. They were, you know, kind of stunned and afraid.
So this happened right in front of the school, or
yeah,
y'all
yes,
just left, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, this is Blue. Uh-huh. This is a different school.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, and he's hurt. He's wandering around. So eventually, the ambulance gets there and takes him away. And so we do the live shot. We didn't even go back to the station. I don't mm-hmm. know, whatever we were covering at Blue didn't make it that night. We mm-hmm. were doing this thing. Anyway, and I'm talking about it, and I said, by the way, the truck is still running. The guy's truck was still running because they had taken him away. There was the truck was still there in the street.
Mm-hmm.
I said, and so for us, obviously, this is a little too close for comfort.
Yeah, let's mm-hmm. get out of
you
here.
Know?
Yeah. Oh, man, yeah. That's crazy.
But, yeah, you've seen things. God has blessed me.
Yeah.
I mean, I've
yeah.
been in situations where I guess it could have been me.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's one thing.
And speaking on social media, how was it with the saturation of reporting now with, you know, because everybody has a camera now, everybody can report everything. How did you have to alter your way of telling a story as far as with reporting with so many different stories going on?
Like, you know, I didn't alter my no. reporting at all. I mean, I report the truth. The truth is the mm-hmm. truth, or at least the truth as I see it.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. no, I mean, what that does, though, as I said, with all these people out here, that has some effect.
Mm-hmm.
Have y'all paid attention to Kilmo News?
No, I haven't heard of it.
You haven't heard of
that? No.
Well, I guess you must be too far from D.C., but in the city, there is this guy. He calls his service, if you will, Kilmo News.
Mm-hmm.
He goes out and shoots this stuff. Okay.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got his number.
Uh-huh.
I think every reporter that's a serious reporter has got Kilmo's number.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Because he gets there and it's like basically, you know, years ago, I think it's in the early 90s, mm-hmm. right? I'm walking down the street and this guy yells at me, "Hey, TV man. I'm going to kill this guy. Put me on the news." And I said to him, I said, "Well, you have to do more than that to get on the news." Because, you know, back then they were having almost 500 murders year.
Murder capital it was.
You kill somebody. Yeah. I mean, it's got to be something different, interesting. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Killing somebody is no, yeah. it's not news. Right. Let's face it. Killing people in D.C. is not news.
That's crazy.
It's not
to say
killing
that.
People is news. Right. You know what I'm saying? I mean, mm-hmm. that's how it is. It's almost 300 murders in 23. Mm-hmm. So the TV stations, to a lot of large degree, have pulled back on it because it really is not.
Yeah.
It's got to be something different. I mean, if it's a child, if it's an elderly person, somebody that's totally innocent, that gets some attention. Mm-hmm. But a lot of this stuff really just doesn't get any attention. You know, JoJo shot Billy Bob. You know, it's sad, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I know
they're both
me.
Out there dealing drugs and got mad at each other, and one of them shot the other one. Is this something mm-hmm. that they're going to put on the news? Probably not.
See, I know me. I stopped watching news a long time ago because the news had become so depressing. Like what you said, just with all the murder, it's always it was nothing. It wasn't a lot of happiness being reported.
There never is a lot of happiness being reported. But again, it's the same old story to some mm-hmm. degree. Now, this is why I mentioned Kilmo.
Mm-hmm.
Kilmo covers that stuff because a lot of times we don't cover it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we didn't. I'm not we now anymore. Yeah. But the regular stations didn't cover it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But Kilmo was covering all this stuff. And so what would happen, sometimes there would be a news story that suddenly was important to us.
Mm-hmm.
We had not covered it, but we could get it from Kilmo.
Okay.
Pay Kilmo and he would give it to you, you know, mm-hmm. and so, or talk to Kilmo and he would get it. And it wasn't just homicides. It can mm-hmm. be a number of things that but he's out there in the street.
Okay.
All the time. He's covering, and the people know him and they're calling him with information. They're sending him pictures. They're sending mm-hmm. him video. Mm-hmm. So really, it's social media uh-huh. does a better job of covering yeah. crime in D.C. than the regular yeah. television stations wow. and certainly
that's
the newspapers.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
But Kilmo is a force there. Mm-hmm. That's not his real name. And he doesn't go to the scene. He doesn't go to a crime scene.
It might be a good
scene.
Idea not to put his real name up there.
Right. He didn't have his face out there. He goes to the scene.
Mm-hmm.
He does his work. And he's not exactly undercover. Some people probably might figure out who he is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he goes and he gets that information, or people get it and just send it to him.
Just send it to him. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But he is a service in D.C.
Oh, yeah.
Every I'm going to have to look station, him up. Yeah. Every TV station in D.C. has Kilmo's number.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm familiar with the term Kilmo.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the term.
Yeah.
What is Kilmo?
Yeah. It can mean a variety of things, but it's more like slang for like just chill, nah. Stop, you know what I mean? Shut up, whatever you wanted to mean at that time. You
can. I had moved out of D.C.
Not kill more people, huh?
That's what No, that's not what it is.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with murder.
Yeah,
itself.
Exactly.
Yeah,
really?
No. Interesting.
No.
I remember when I first heard it, I thought that though, because I had moved out of D.C. Now, I'm still in D.C. often, mm-hmm. but as far as being in certain neighborhoods, the neighborhoods that I used to be in, where I would pick up this slang, I haven't been there for years. So I don't know the new slang and exactly what everything means mm-hmm. anymore.
Yeah.
You know, but I did know that Kilmo didn't have to do with
it. Yeah, yeah.
And I figured that out by using context clues. Seeing people on Facebook, you know, just in conversations and somebody would say Kilmo. And I'm like, oh, okay, this has nothing to do with killing.
Okay. You know. There was another one called Murder and Mayhem, D.C. And I did a story on just these social media guys, mm-hmm. you know, because mm-hmm. they're out there, you know. But Kilmo's the best one. He is good.
Yeah. You definitely need to look him up, though.
So what was your process in looking for a story? Like, how did you come up with ideas? Did you just was in, outside and just say, I'm going to just ride around, and if I see something interesting, I'm going to try to
generally,
put something together?
Yeah, generally, the way it works is you read the newspapers, mm-hmm. right? You talk to people. Look at social media.
Mm-hmm.
It could come from anywhere, you know? Mm-hmm. And then basically I would suggest a story in the morning, or a series of stories. And 90% of the time, Channel 7 would do whatever I suggested.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But unless they had something particularly they want to cover, then then I'd end up covering that.
Okay.
But yeah, your ideas, you're out there. You know, you're out there in the street. Or people call you, too. A lot of that, you know.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I always told them, I said, if they call the station and they mm-hmm. ask for my number, give them my number.
Okay.
You know, mm-hmm. I'm not hiding my number. I put my number on Facebook, too. You know, I'm a news reporter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to hide from you. Call mm-hmm. me, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And what goes into the day of being the borough chief? You know what I mean? Like, what is...
Bureau chief is just a title.
Okay.
I mean, it was, it just basically means the main reporter in D.C.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
I don't run a bureau. Let me say, I had an office
mm-hmm.
In this bureau.
Okay.
But, you know, I don't have anybody under me. Mm-hmm. I'm not hiring people.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? It's just a title. They called me the D.C. bureau chief. The Brad Bell was the Maryland bureau chief. Mm-hmm. And Gail Pennybacher, when they started this out, was the Virginia bureau chief.
Okay. Okay.
And that's it. It was just it's just a title. And, but I noticed the other stations picked it up and started using that.
Yeah, too. Yeah, yeah.
Bill Lord, news director, Channel 7, came up with that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So now that you retired, what's next?
Well, one of the things that I've always been interested in Africa, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I know you've been to Ghana a few times, correct?
Once.
Okay.
Once. But I've been to Africa several times.
Okay.
I spent my honeymoon in Zimbabwe. Me and Glory were there for a month.
Oh, wow.
Okay, and then I've been to Africa several times for Channel 7,
mm-hmm.
When they blew up the U.S. Embassy.
Mm-hmm.
Also, tracing roots. My roots went, male roots went back to Nigeria. So
we went to
this town in Nigeria where they found a match, you know, called Ibadan. Huge, 3 million people live in this town.
Wow.
It's huge. I'd never heard of it before.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back on my own trying to find more there. And so I've been to Africa a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I've retired, you know, if the visa comes through, some of this paperwork is so complicated.
Going back? Yeah,
anyway.
You're going back.
If this comes through, I'm going to Ghana.
Okay.
And I've been there before. An interesting thing, a lot of black people are going to Ghana. When I went, I think I told you I studied French. Mm-hmm. I went to Canada. One of the people I met there, my best friend in Canada,
mm-hmm.
is this guy named Emmanuel Ofori. And he was among those Africans who would go to Canada. If you went to Canada and declared yourself a refugee, they just let you come on in.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That was They'll give you citizenship and all?
Right
oh,
away.
Oh, wow.
That's how they were back then in the 80s. So Emmanuel, and he just came to Canada and declared himself a refugee. So, you know, at that point, you know, it was like, you know, I met him on the streets of Canada, mm-hmm. and, you know, he's a Ghanaian. And we stayed in touch.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So he eventually marries a Canadian, mm-hmm. Black Canadian woman. And
I've never heard that term before, Black Canadian. Well, anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, well, anyway, I guess, you know, most Canadians are not black.
Yeah,
that's why
yeah,
I just
course,
made, that,
yeah.
made that point. But anyway, and you know, they got married and they've got adult sons now.
Mm-hmm.
So they you know, Canada's pretty cold. So they decided. Mm-hmm. They moved back. They bought a house in Ghana.
Mm.
And so they basically spend 6 months a year in Ghana. And then they come back. Their kids are at their house in mm-hmm. Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will see him this time when I go over
there.
Okay. One of the things I want to do, though, is media. I want to do... pieces, and I don't.
You want to get exactly more of social media, or like
it'll be documentaries, it'll be social media. Yeah, it could be documentary. But you know, one thing I've noticed in social media, you don't want to sit there and watch 30 minutes or something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But you will watch 2 minutes. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I'm thinking of doing these little 2 minute wonders. You know,
okay,
what I mean?
Okay.
On different aspects of Africa. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the last time I was there, I did this little thing that I really sort of liked.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Cape Coast Castle. You know, that was where Obama went, and it was a slave castle, right?
Oh, wow.
And so we're in there, and they have these guys, and the guy gives me a tour, and I use a lot of it. And he says, "You see this what we're standing on? It looks like mud that's dried."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "This is DNA. This is toilet.
Oh, wow.
This is sweat. This is tears. This is what was left there," because what they would do, they would bring these people here and they'd pack them 200 in a room.
Mm.
And they would be there. They had to sleep there, whatever,
for
2 months until the ship came to get them, to take them to America.
Oh, wow.
He said, "All of this is still here. That's what's still here on this." I thought that was really interesting. Wow, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So little things like that, I'm thinking of, you know, maybe getting a YouTube channel or something like that and putting little things like that on to give people little stories.
That's nice. That's nice. Yeah.
Now, the plan is to go to Ghana to spend like a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to fly to Madagascar.
Okay.
Madagascar is in East Africa on the other side.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What's interesting there is, you know, I do these DNA tests, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my DNA shows that I'm 75% African, mainly from Nigeria, but from Ghana as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 18% European. I'm 4.5% Native American and 2% Asian. Now, I understood all the rest of them.
Uh-huh.
Where do Asians come from? You know, I didn't kind of figure that out until I've been reading.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a source of slaves in this country, Madagascar.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Madagascar is an island on East Africa settled by Asians and Africans.
Disney told us about Madagascar with the cartoons.
With the caterpillar.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's true. With the lemurs or whatever
right,
they call them.
Exactly. Yeah.
We didn't know nothing about it until then.
But I thought, now it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of these slaves from Madagascar were brought to New York and a lot of them to Virginia.
Oh,
and a lot of the Fords came out of Virginia, you know what I mean? Some, you know, via Virginia, Kentucky. So I thought, that makes sense. Because we don't have Chinese rollers, you know what I'm saying? I'm saying, so that makes sense. Mm-hmm. There's an Asia connection. I said, okay, I'd like to see that place too.
Speaking of slaves, I also seen you have a conversation about the Cherokee situation with, because I didn't know until then, actually into that conversation, that they had, I think you did a piece on it, or?
Oh yeah, I did.
And there was also like a back and forth between you and them about as far as with, where they were trying to kick you out of the coalition or something like that?
No, they tried to kick the blacks out of the tribe.
Okay.
Okay. You know, it was this one guy named Chad Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's not the only one, but he was the worst, in my opinion. He was the chief, and he decided that his thing was to kick the blacks out of the tribe. So we're going to have a referendum to kick you out of the tribe. And if more people vote to kick you out, then you're out. I mean, that was his thing. So, you know, my family has been connected to the Cherokee Nation, and I'm sure this 4.5% of Indian blood I got is from Cherokee Nation, right? My family was kicked, has been with the Cherokee Nation for almost 200 years. And if you look at genealogy, and I study that stuff sometime, people in my family born before 1839 were born in Georgia, North Carolina, Tennessee. People after 1839 were born in Indian Territory, which is what Oklahoma became Oklahoma after, but it was Indian territory. When my father was born there, it was still Indian territory. When my grandmother was born there, it was still Indian territory. And if you go and look at the roles, but what had happened, I was out in Oklahoma doing a story on a water project for a little town. We'd interviewed the chief, a guy named Ross Swimmer at the time. And after the interview, I said, "See if you can find my family in that roll book, because I know we've always been connected to the Cherokees." And he found my father. He found my aunt. He found mm-hmm. my grandmother. And he said, yeah, they're on the Freedmen rolls. And I said, Freedmen? What are that? He said, well, they're the former slaves.
Oh, wow.
And I remember the television crew was wrapping mm-hmm. up their equipment, and they stopped. And one said, you mean the Indians had
own
slaves?
Wow, that's
he
crazy.
Says, well, we don't like to talk about it, but yes. And so what had happened was...
And was that the first time you ever heard of that as
well? Well, I knew Freedmen. Okay. I knew that my father and my mother and my grandmother got money,
mm-hmm.
which they call their Indian money from the Cherokee Nation. Okay. But I didn't know the explanation for it. I didn't know what the reasoning was. So at that point, I got interested and decided to like, really? So before I had gone to this town, the town was called Tahlequah, which mm-hmm. is the capital of the Cherokee Nation, I had called my relatives up in Kansas, mm-hmm. where I grew up. And my cousin said, well, you know, you have cousins in Tahlequah. You ought to look them up. And so I looked up my cousins. They had this book, which was written by a professor at the University of Northeast Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. His name was Rudia Halliburton, and it was called Red Over Black. And in this book were interviews done during the 1930s by the WPA,
mm-hmm.
including an interview with my great-grandmother, Phyllis Pettit, and her brother, Johnson Thompson. And they told of being Indian slaves, how they were freed from slavery in Texas, because they were slaves down there of these Cherokees,
mm-hmm.
and how they had come back to Oklahoma, mm-hmm. the home where their father was from.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like 7, 8 years old. And they described this journey of like 5 weeks where they had to fight wolves off with fire from their camp and to get back to.
So they made like a pilgrimage from Oklahoma.
From where
to
they
Texas.
Were born, uh-huh. they went back to Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. Well, they were in Texas because what happened when the Civil War broke out, these Indians wanted to get their slaves mm-hmm. in a safe place, which was Texas. Because, you know, but in Oklahoma, it was so much turmoil. And in Kansas, if they'd got them up there, they'd have been free.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those,
wow,
those
that
types
is crazy
of things.
To
so
hear.
My great grandmother, who I didn't know her, but her daughter raised me. Mm. Okay. My grandmother that was raised me until she died when I was 16.
Oh, wow.
So she talked about her mother. So, I mean, this was close. What, you know, it's like, I'm dealing with somebody one generation out of slavery.
Oh, wow.
Her mother was a slave.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So anyway, at this point, I get interested in this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a documentary on it. I did do a piece on that, which we called Black Slaves, Red Masters.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get interested in this stuff, and then I find out that they are trying to kick us out of the tribe.
Oh, wow.
And so there's this
Was your family still getting that Indian money, as they say?
Well, no, they would have these payoffs. I mean, when I say Indian money, the federal government would pay off all the Cherokees. And since they were Cherokees, they would get some money. But it wasn't like a regular.
Yeah. I was just making.
No, it wasn't a regular thing. But, you know, they got money. I think my mother got $66.
Goodness, wow. Yeah. Okay.
Well, let me tell you, $66
at that time,
in 1965 and 64 would buy a heck of a lot of stuff today.
That's true.
But because our rent wasn't but $40 a month. I mean, that was more than I.
Yeah.
That was more than I rent.
Yeah. He's really telling y'all his age.
Again, my father was closer. He got more money, and my grandmother got a lot more mm-hmm. money. Mm-hmm. So it was just depending on, you know, how close you were to the actual roll book. Because grandma and daddy were on the rolls. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was no question. My mother wasn't on the rolls. Her dad was on mm-hmm. the rolls, but she wasn't on the rolls.
Let's talk about your family more, like go back. Let's go back to how was your upbringing coming up? Like, how was family life coming up?
You know, it's a black family life, poor black mm-hmm. people in Kansas.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, just wild, some wild stuff. You know, I mean, it was, that's why I'm comfortable around black people, because I grew up poor, black,
mm-hmm.
poor and black.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no problem with poor and black people, because those are my people. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So.
What was it that actually brought you to D.C.?
Oh, well, by that time, you know, I went to college, you know. Mm-hmm. I went to the University of Kansas, got a degree in journalism,
mm-hmm.
and I went to the University of Minnesota and got a master's. I didn't actually get my degree, but I worked in the graduate program in, mm-hmm. in Minnesota, and then I got hired by a station there, you know.
In radio, correct?
Well, initially, right. I worked at the radio station in the first time I got money for radio was in Minnesota.
Okay.
Right. I used to get credit, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
But I got actual.
Did you start off as an intern?
I was a disc jockey in Kansas, you know, so I got paid for that. But then in terms of news, mm-hmm. I got paid in Minnesota, and I would do stories on the weekends. And then I got an internship
mm-hmm.
with the television station there and a radio station there. And these are well-connected stations. In fact, CBS subsequently bought them. But they wanted more blacks at the network.
Okay.
And so the idea was to have a training program, and I was in that training program.
Okay.
And after you were in the training program so long, then they would bring you to New York and you would work there, and they actually didn't hire that many people. I think I was the only person they actually hired on that mm-hmm. program. But
what made you go into journalism in school? Like, was that something that you always aspired to be, or?
Well, it was one of those things where I wanted to be on TV. I didn't necessarily want to be a news person. And I sort of liked the idea of being the person that said, this is Channel 6.
Oh, okay.
But that was not much of a job.
You just wanted to do voiceovers.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But that yeah. wasn't much of a job.
Okay.
So at that point, you know, I've always been interested in the news. I mean, you, for example, when I was a seven-year-old boy, I might have been the only seven-year-old, I'd be sitting there watching Walter Cronkite.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean?
That is funny.
I'd be sitting there watching the news. I always was interested in what was going on. You know, President Kennedy was killed when I was 10 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I can imagine, you know, you go home for lunch, you come mm-hmm. back, they got the radio on, you just found out the president was killed. And, you know, amongst black people, Kennedy was very popular because he was the civil rights guy. You know, mm-hmm. Martin Luther King got locked up. Richard Nixon didn't call him. John Kennedy called Mrs. King to find out how he was doing. So all this stuff reverberated. And here's this guy who's our hero
mm-hmm.
who gets killed in Texas. You know, I was totally into that.
But how many different presidents you talked to in your time?
I don't know if I've talked to him. I mean, I probably spent the most time with Reagan because I was working at the White House when he was the president.
Okay.
You know? So
okay.
I'd yell questions. He would be leaving his helicopter and going into the White House or leaving the White House, and he'd yell, "Mr. Reagan!" You know? Yeah.
Did you ever cover sports?
Yeah. You know, I didn't. I'd never been a kind of a sports junkie, but I've covered sports stories. You know, CBS, you had to cover whatever they wanted you to cover.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes we'd have these late night newscasts for the local stations. And mm-hmm. sometimes, particularly in Atlanta, I would have to be the one who would write these things up and read them, and mm-hmm. they'd send them out on the network. And then sometimes I would do stories on sports figures, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. their lives, that sort of thing. And I'll never forget, we were in Buffalo, New York. And you remember Nate Archibald? I don't know if you ever heard of the name.
Yeah.
He's a little tiny guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was covering a story on somebody else, another player, but Nate tore his Achilles tendon.
Yeah, he's a basketball player, NBA.
And mm-hmm. so I remember one of the big players picked this little guy up. He was like 5 foot tall, maybe even that fat. Uh-huh. He could play though. I mean, you can imagine he playing in NBA.
He's a Hall of Famer.
He was a star on the Kansas City team when they mm-hmm. had the Kansas City Omaha Kings. Like, yeah, mm-hmm. back then. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that was a shot I'll never forget. Another player picks up Nate. He's walking Nate Archibald off the court. Nate's wife is behind him crying, and they.
That is a
scene I will never forget.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that was in Buffalo.
Yeah. If anything you can do, if you get into social media, you can just sit in front of a camera and just talk history, because you're real good at retaining information and just have so much history in your mind that you can really just tell.
Because
some of the stories, and you're like, I know you've been known in D.C. as one of the greatest storytellers in the history of D.C. and reporting in D.C. So, and I can see that in with sitting and talking to you, you know, how you tell a story is just really, it's captivating.
Well, you know, one reason if I have a ability to tell a story, this is true. My father was a coon hunter.
Okay.
He had dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And then these old guys, mostly white guys from Oklahoma,
mm-hmm.
would come up and they'd sit around the kitchen table drinking coffee with whiskey in it. And they would start telling these stories, these stories of the hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And my little ears would be just big. I'd be sitting there listening to it. I love that stuff. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I love these stories about dogs and the hunt. And that was that was one of the things that I don't know that I think if I had any talent at telling stories, I think I got it there as a little kid sitting next to my dad listening to these stories about the hunt.
That's
I love stories on like that. You know,
so was storytelling going to lead you to writing a book?
I hope so, but you know, that takes a discipline. You know, I don't know if I have that much at this point. You know,
I have 7 published books. It takes a lot of discipline.
So
it takes a lot.
So I don't know. I don't know. You know, but everybody says, "Yeah, you should write a book." They've been saying that for 30 years. But.
Yeah. It's a great idea, and then you sit down. And you're like, is this really a great idea? Like, you know, it's nerve-wracking, but I'm gonna tell you the most rewarding part is writing the end. I'm telling you, it is so rewarding, and it makes you realize everything that I went through to get to this point was worth it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, how long did it take you to write a book?
Well, it depends on the book that we're talking about. Well,
give me some time.
Let me see. The
salacious books that he wrote, it didn't take him long at all.
No, I don't have any salacious books.
I'm joking.
But I woke up one morning during COVID, and the whole world, at the time, I was writing newspaper articles for one of the newspapers on the Eastern Shore. So I woke up and I said, everybody is panicking right now. I think I'm going to write a book on meditation. I woke up that morning, I wrote the book, and released it on Amazon the very next morning. That was the quickest.
You wrote it in a day?
Yes, just that day. And it's not an extremely long book, but it's called, I can't even remember the name of it, but I do know that it's like 30 days. So it gives you, each day gives you something else to think about and to meditate on. So, and it says it's something like 30 days of new life or something like that. I can't remember. But that was the fastest. The longest, I had started. The funny thing is, it didn't even start off as a book. I was coaching a flag football team, but it was an adult flag football team. I was playing as well. I was the player and coach. And I used to send these emails to my team every week at the beginning of the week, but they were motivational emails. So a few years later, I went back, I'm going back through these emails, and I said, this seems like it could go into a book. So I decided to turn it into a book. My father passed in 2013, and on his birthday, November 13th, 2013, I released that book. So that probably took me, I would say, about 6 years from the time that I first sent the first email to the time that I actually released the book.
Oh, okay, I see. Within 6 years working on the book.
Exactly, yeah. Right. But there was work that had already been done that I didn't know was going to turn into a book.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
Right, so, and then there is one that I have yet to complete. And when I say I've yet to complete it, I started writing this book during COVID, during the height of COVID. So we're talking about 2020. And since then, since 2020, I have one paragraph left to finish this book. One paragraph. I am such a perfectionist that I can't get this the way I want. And I said, you know what? I just let my inspiration come to me. So I just let it go. And when it comes to me, look, if it's 20 years from now and it comes to me, then that's when I will release that book. You know, so the longest one, I mean, as far as actual writing, right now, we're at 4 years. We're at 4 years. So we'll see how long it takes for me to complete that one. But I can't wait to write the end at the end of that book.
I think we're good. We can wrap it up because I don't want to keep you out too late. You know what I mean? I know you retired. You don't got nothing better to do. You know, you got nothing better to do. You know, catching up with some TV shows, catching up with a few series and things of that nature. You know, we're wondering. You know, so day to day now, what are you doing? Like, what does your day look like? Are you mentoring anybody as far as broadcasting? I know you get a lot of questions. Probably get a lot of emails still asking about information and stories and things of that nature.
No, not
nobody's
really
reaching out to you, ask you
about
it.
No, I don't. I don't think so. I mean, I'm, you know, I've been on the Martin Luther King parade committee.
Oh, okay.
For years, and so I was involved with that. Mm-hmm. But no, I actually, you know, for the most part, it's just me and Miko. That's the dog.
Okay.
And I get up in the morning and so, okay, Miko, what are we going to do today? It is weird not going back to work. You know what I'm saying?
Do you after think the, boredom may send you back?
Who?
You think boredom may send you back?
Boredom?
Yes.
Will send me back to work?
Yes.
No,
he doesn't look bored at all. He looks like he's just...
the good thing is, and this is you know, this is one of the things you kind of wonder about. Because, mm-hmm. you know, as I was going up, I mean, let me say it this way. I was a TV reporter, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I did okay. But there were times when, you know, things weren't so good. And I wondered, I said, you know...
You talking financial-wise?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, and I was wondering, I said, am I going to be able to you know, because I've got this house. I said, if they fire me, am I going to, you know, be able to lose this house? Am I going to be able to feed my kids?
Right.
You know, I mean, it was rough. I can remember crying in front of the Christmas tree one Christmas.
Being young, we thought everybody that was on TV was rich. We thought that if you was on TV, you was rich.
Let me tell you, a lot of times you're dealing with stuff, and I can remember why. I'm a member of Ebenezer United Methodist Church, mm-hmm. right? Before then, I was at a church down the street called Lincoln Park.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Lincoln Park, and they're always down there praying. They like to kneel and pray. I said to squat and pray because my shoes had holes in them. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, so, but that's what I'm saying. You gotta you know, feed these kids. Mm-hmm. You gotta pay this house note. You gotta mm-hmm. do these sorts of things. So you know it. I did learn about the you know the value of money.
Really?
My wife didn't work in those days, and it's wonderful for the kids because I got kids that she you know she stayed home. She worked with the kids.
I did get to meet your daughter. That was beautiful. I think
with
I met
Gina.
Her at the church.
Okay, yeah. So both of my kids are doing very well. Mm-hmm. You know, one's a communications director. One's a vice president of a hospital. Mm-hmm. You know, and their mother is the main reason that they have come out as well as they have because she stayed home with them.
Okay.
And she, but it meant we didn't have as much money.
Right.
But they never were in daycare.
But look where they are now.
Exactly. But that's what I'm saying. Exactly. I mean, that's what I'm saying. You look at the kids. Kids and mm-hmm. you think, oh my, she sacrificed for
yeah.
those kids.
Yeah, that's
and that's a wonderful thing. But at the same time, you know, that was a concern. But what I was saying was, you know, you try to do the right thing
mm-hmm.
and you do right. And then when you get old, like I am now, I don't really have any money problems. You know what I'm saying? It's, mm-hmm. it's one of these things where I got my pension.
Mm-hmm.
I got my first check this month.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good check.
Uh-huh.
I waited until I was 70 before I just started getting it.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a good pension check. I have savings. And basically, I'm going to make the same amount of money
that
in
you
retirement
while you was working.
As I made working.
Oh, that's beautiful. Oh, wow.
So that's what I said. So it's not like I need to go to mm-hmm. work. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But, you know, and I hope I don't, you know, start chasing young women or something.
Yeah.
I tell you what, this is the time to do it.
Yeah, I mean, why not? I mean, why not? Why not?
No.
I'm married, so of course when I retire, I'm hoping to still be married when I retire. But, you know, hey. Who knows? When you get to Ghana, you might meet somebody, you know?
Mm-hmm. I doubt it.
I don't know. And I'm not coming back.
I'm not coming back.
Yeah.
My daughter's going to say, you fool, get your husband on that plane.
And actually, I was going to ask you, that's no plans of actually trying to move to Africa.
You know, I've thought about that. You know, one of the things I've thought about, I said, you know, a person like me who knows writing and grammar
mm-hmm.
and stuff,
mm-hmm.
I could be of use to young people mm-hmm. in a place like Africa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've thought about that. I don't know. Perhaps. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. But I don't, you know, again, you know, you're 70 now. How much time have you got? That you
got plenty
your
of time.
Mind,
you
your
got
mind
plenty
is
of time.
Good and everything.
Your mind seems just as sharp as any pencil I ever wrote with. You
yeah,
know what I mean?
Yeah. So, well, we'll see. And hopefully you're right.
Yeah.
At least you do feel somewhat useful. So my thing is February I go to Ghana. March I come back.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're having a family reunion in Kansas,
mm-hmm.
and I got a house out there that needs a lot of work. So I'm gonna, me and the dog are gonna go to Kansas,
oh,
try
yeah.
to get the bathroom fixed, get the house painted and the woodwork done, you know, that sort of thing.
No one's living in the house or taking care of it or anything like that?
No. Okay. No, what has really been rough for me though, mm-hmm. death. in the family. Oh, that's one of the things, I guess, when you get older, because I lost my wife.
I know you lost a couple sisters.
I lost my wife in 21. Mm-hmm. In 22, I lost two sisters within a month.
Oh, wow.
You know? Mm-hmm. And one of them lived in that house in Kansas. And then a couple of weeks, was it last month, I got a call. I lost my nephew, you know? And I was his beneficiary, so I had to go out there and handle all that stuff, and that's still in the process. That's still in the process of happening. So, dealing with death is.
I remember having to do that for my father. I've never had to arrange and things like that. My father passed like a few weeks before your wife did in August of 21. So, like, and that was hard. Like doing the arrangement and going through. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. Mm-hmm. I was hoping that my aunts and his sisters and all of them would take over all of that for me, and they were like, "No, this is something that you need to do." But it was just like the whole process was just
that's right. Well, and with my sister, you know, there was nobody. It was like it's not like somebody else could do it. Mm-hmm. No, I had to do it. Yeah. Period. Yeah. That's it. I had to do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, not that I didn't want to do it, but I mean, it was just like it was hurtful.
Yeah.
It was, you know, and then I, you know, it was like all our lives were 4 years apart. You know, she called me up. We talk. We can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's that's rough.
That's got to be hard losing a sibling and you know, just losing people. Period. But
So losing all of these people, do you sometimes experience survivor's remorse?
That I'm somewhat guilty or something, you know, for still living while they died.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. But I do miss them.
Is that really a thing? Is that really a thing?
I think I've heard it more of
somebody going through a tragedy and or a car accident or something and they survive and somebody else passed. But I've never heard of it exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
Just with family members or siblings and stuff like that.
I've heard it with people getting older and the people that are their age.
Watching everybody around you.
Right. They're watching everybody else around the past.
Well, that's true. And it has hit me that suddenly you got these people that, you know, like, again, like my nephew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing that got me about him, he died on December 8th.
Mm-hmm. One day after my birthday. That's crazy.
He was supposed to get his first retirement check on January 2nd.
Oh, wow.
He died before he could get his first retirement
check. That is crazy. Wow.
You know? That, and I thought, God, you know, that's unfair. You know?
Yeah, that is crazy.
You know? And of course, he never told tell me I was a beneficiary. He didn't tell anybody in the family. Mm-hmm. We didn't know. Mm-hmm. He died. They said he died of liver cancer. Yeah. And we just found out. That's what my sister died of, too. Mm. Same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, you know.
I think anytime anybody around you passes, anybody that's close or a family member, it makes you think about your own mortality. You know what I mean? There's no way not to. You know, you think about, you know, you wake up every morning and you're like, one of these mornings, I'm not going to wake up, and you think about it like, how is it going to happen? I try not to think about it anymore.
Yeah.
I try my best not to think about it because I think that kind of energy just brings on.
Well, yeah, you don't dwell on it because you got too much, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You got a whole crew over there.
Yeah, and I got two grandkids that I just had too. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that's what I'm saying.
So I at least want to see them grow up.
Yeah, so I'm saying you got a lot going on. Mm-hmm. You're a busy person.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I don't. That's just me and the dog. And so, you know, you try to find things to do. And as I said, this Africa trip, I think, will be something that will be good. Mm-hmm. I plan to.
Are you going
to
treat it like a vacation or like a work trip? Almost?
I think kind of a combination of both. Mm-hmm. A combination of both, you know. And I think I'll be, you know, there getting stuff done, but at the same time, but Ghana's interesting, and I think African Americans will be particularly interested because a lot of African Americans are moving to Ghana.
Yeah,
and there's a story there. You know, if you could talk to these folks about what they do, what they think.
How receptive are the people there? Because you know, you hear stories about the Native Africans not really accepting Black Americans over there as much as, like, you know, they look at us like Americanized. People,
well, you know,
looking at us like white people.
I guess it depends. It depends. Now, my experience has been, and I've been to Africa several times, they like us.
Oh, yeah?
You know, they, particularly Black Americans, they like us. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's my experience. And they sort of emulate us. I mean, you look at the hairstyles over here, pretty soon you'll see them over there. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So,
and I've been to Nigeria, and they loved us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They loved us.
That's been my experience is that, you know. And then the thing about Ghana that I think is a little better, they're not as let's say, rough as Nigeria. Okay. They're more laid back, you know, and Nigeria is kind of more of a rough country, you know.
Yeah. Right.
But I think Ghana is more laid back.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the story of Kwame Nkrumah, you know, mm-hmm, he was the first president of Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
He went to school here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah?
He worked his way through school preaching in black churches.
Oh, wow.
You know, and so, you know, when I went over there, you know, they know all these African Americans.
Was he born in America or did he come here?
He's a Ghanaian. Okay. He's from Ghana.
Okay.
But one of the interesting things is, like a lot of these African countries, they look toward Britain as their, you know, as their whatever, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But Ghana, when Nkrumah always looked to the United States because mm-hmm, that's his experience,
okay,
is the United States. Mm-hmm. And so, if you look at, you know, some of the history, one of the things I didn't even know, but I thought was really cool, the very first foreign leader to visit when John Kennedy was elected was Kwame Nkrumah. Mm. And there's the video of Kennedy waiting at the airport for Nkrumah's plane to land.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And, you know, and, mm-hmm, and that whole thing. And, of course, another thing that's kind of funny. So, you know, they have the president's limousine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in Ghana, the limousine that they preserve, it's a Cadillac. And of course, Ghana, their power plant was financed to a great degree by, mm-hmm, the United States. And Ghana is among the countries with, mm-hmm, with the best power system West Africa.
Yeah, like Nigeria.
Yeah, well, yeah, right. NEPA took light, they call it, when the power file. Apparently, it does fail there in Ghana, mm-hmm, sometime, too.
Oh, it does? Okay.
But I don't think it's nearly as bad as Nigeria.
Right, yeah.
Right. But so you got that thing. And the interesting thing when we were over there, you know, so many African Americans are going over there. You've heard of the Divine Nine, you know, the fraternities, mm-hmm, yeah, and sororities. Yeah. So they got something. So Nkrumah was a Sigma.
Oh, wow.
He's part of that whole thing.
Okay.
So,
man, that's dope. It is nice.
Yeah,
man, it's always a pleasure talking to somebody, man, who has so much history, you know, and just have a wide knowledge of history and talked and kicked it with a lot of different people in all walks of life, you know.
And it's good to be sitting here with a little kid that everybody said would have been nothing, mm-hmm, and here he is.
Did they say that about me?
Well, I didn't say they.
who said that about me? Is that what they were saying?
I said that's what they would have said.
Oh, already.
That's my assumption, really, right?
Yeah.
But in that situation.
But that's the narrative, though.
But in that situation. Yeah. But here you are. Mm-hmm. You are a responsible citizen, father, husband, and role model.
Yeah,
and that is absolutely wonderful. So you to tell me I was, you tell me I was going to be sitting here with Christopher. Puffing gas in the exile.
That's what makes all this bittersweet, man. That's what makes this all bittersweet, because coming full circle like that, you know what I mean? You know, when I was 10 years old and you interviewing me and I had my little dirty Michael Jordan shirt on, you know, and I'm sitting there and I watched it back like a couple times the other day and I was like, man, this is going to be just so nice to be able to sit down with you and kick it and have a conversation and just.
Oh, yeah. This is one of the things that makes me happy to be a journalist to have witnessed this.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that I smile about.
And you know, we've been keeping in touch over the years, you know, and I'm going to pick your brain as I get into media and into broadcasting and stuff. You already know I'm going to drop you a line every now and then. I'm going to pick your brain and just ask you about certain things, and we may ask you to, you know, just talk to you every now and then as well, you know, because you don't have nothing but time, so you don't have anything to do. Especially we want to talk to you when you come back from Africa, you know, and talk about that whole experience and everything like that, man.
This is very
I had so many questions I wanted to ask you, but Tom is not going to let me go, because I wanted to do a deep dive. I wanted to know more about when you was in the streets and stuff like that. You know what I mean? What was you out there doing? You know, I can't see Sam out there, you know, with his proper talking, you know what I mean, throwing money at the strip club or anything like that. You know what I mean?
Okay, so next interview is at the strip club. We're just going to see how you act at the strip club.
Do they still have them?
Do they? Yeah, they do.
Yeah,
they have them. In a while, you know. Yeah. Well, last year I went to one. Last year I did, you know, when me and the wife was going through some things, you know, I went and, you know, but it was just, it wasn't the same, you know, when you're young and when you're out there, it's a different type of party.
The Skylark is no more New York Avenue anymore. Yeah.
It was so funny. I was doing a live shot there on New York Avenue and one of our directors at Channel 7, he says, Sam, says, look to your right. He said, you see that green building there? I said, yeah. He said, that's where I hang out. The Skylark.
I remember that. I remember that.
I used to love that place.
I never actually went in the Skylark. I went
in there for you.
Oh, man, this is dope. Well, man, we can wrap this up, man. You know, we can wrap this up, man. I can sit here and talk for hours for real. I know.
Yeah, well, before we go, I just want to thank you for all of those years of just telling the truth.
Yeah.
You know, and reporting on the news the way that it's supposed to be done. Mm-hmm. My mother, when I told my mother that we were interviewing, she was like, oh, my gosh, are you serious? She said, yes, I know exactly who Sam Ford is. Mm-hmm. And to see her get that excited. Because my mother, if she's not feeling somebody, she's going to tell me, you know. So for her to get that excited about this, you know, that was a big deal. And mm-hmm. I think it says a lot about you and the man that you are and exactly what you mean to D.C., which you mean, I'm sure, to Kansas as well. But of course, I'm a D.C. boy, so I got to speak for, you know, for us.
We claiming him. D.C. is claiming him. Kansas don't have no claim to him. You know.
But just thank you for everything, that all of your contributions and everything that you mean to the city.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And it's fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for taking me and giving me some inspiration. You know what I mean? When I was out there pumping gas, I thought I might have asked you to pump your gas, and I think that's how it came about. I don't know. It was so long ago.
Yeah, it was so long ago.
Yeah. Oh, he actually, I remember he taking me. I remember when we was at Union Station, I think they had the Parade of Stars. Who was it? At? Lou Rawls. And I got to meet Lou Rawls. I got to meet Dionne Warwick. I think who else was out there? You may not remember. It was so long ago. Yeah, but yeah, I remember. I met Lou Rawls and Dionne Warwick around that same time. You know, he introduced me to him and things. It was nice. It was dope, man. It was dope. I felt like a celebrity for a little while. You know, they was calling me a celebrity around the way for a little while. You know, the funny thing is, a lot of my family didn't get to see the story when it first came out because they didn't have cable at the time, and then you know. With the antennas and how things were, you know what I mean? Especially in my family that was on the Eastern Shore, they didn't get to see anything. So I had to wait until I actually got the tapes at the time. That's how far back it was. The first story was on a tape. It was on a VHS tape, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Probably. Yeah, you know, yeah. And then, yeah. You know, so.
Yeah, yeah, I was digging through archives trying to find stuff because we couldn't find that segment when we went there, you know, when you had your little boys. You were raising them there in Cambridge.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I'm going to find this. And I just went into our morgue, and I just went through them one at a time. It took me hours, but I found it.
Really?
And I knew it was there.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, I knew it was there, but I just had to find it because somebody didn't label something right. Mm-hmm. We found it, and we included it.
Too. Yeah. Yeah, man, let's wrap this up, man. I appreciate everybody for watching. Like, comment, subscribe. Do all of those things that they tell you to do on YouTube. Go check out the website, relicmedia.com. We're going to have a lot of good stuff on there. We're going to come back and talk to Sam again once he make his Ghana trip, you know, hopefully, you know, if he decides to come back to the States, you know, or not, because he may fall in love, you know, and we may not see him again, you know. And I think in Ghana, are they allowed to have multiple wives in Ghana? I don't know.
I don't know either.
That sounds real intriguing. I'm just joking.
I'm interested in wife.
Yeah, yeah. They're trying to come get some of that Indian money from them. You know, you never know. All right, we will wrap it up, man. Appreciate it, man. To Sam Ford, retirement, man. Enjoy your retirement, man.
Thank you.
You know, a lot more years ahead of you. You're looking good, you know. You're looking good, looking healthy, you know, and everything like that, man. Hope to see you here for a lot, long, long time, man.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
All right. Oh, man.
That was great. That was a pleasant change from what we normally do.
Yeah, because you know, normally our podcast, we'd be on.